Welcome, 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 everyone, to episode 38 of the Tech Cars Machines podcast, this time with GE Vernova. This is your host, Ali Tabibian. I usually go straight to introducing our guest, but quite a few listeners are insisting I do more to introduce myself and plug the show. I get queasy thinking about it, but here it goes. About me, I've loved technology since I was a kid, which led to a bachelor and master's degrees in electrical engineering from Stanford. My producer, who's in the studio with me here, is holding up four fingers to get me to mention I got both degrees in 4 years. I finished just as the age of the internet was arriving. I became a technology investment banker, mostly in mergers and acquisitions, and I've been doing it for over 30 years. About half of that time was with the large banks, with my last stop as a managing director at Citigroup in Palo Alto, California. The other half has been as a tech banker with GTK Partners, a firm I co-founded based in San Francisco. Basically, I've been around long enough and intensely enough to have seen everything twice. I think I can help you understand the trends of our day and help you gain long-term perspective, both backwards and forwards. To plug the show, I'd like you to simply give us a like. Here's how. In Spotify, above the episode list, click the About tab, and you will see a rating opportunity right below it. In Apple Podcasts, scroll to the bottom of the episode list, and you'll see it there. In most other podcast players, it'll be something similar. If I showed you our listener statistics, you see why I think we have some of the sharpest podcast listeners around. So I know you've all noticed that the episode artwork has a green background, because this episode is in our Energy Transition series. As usual, we have a guest who's in an important position of leadership. He's Jeff Goldmeer, who heads up the global hydrogen value chain at GE Vernova. GE Vernova is the new name of GE's energy division, which is soon to be an independently traded public company with revenue guidance for 2024 of $34 billion to $35 billion. A very meaningful portion of the world's electricity is generated using GE equipment, and Jeff has been at GE for a long time and also deeply involved in energy transition. A couple of quick points. First, Jeff is a natural teacher. This is one of those episodes I'll bet you'll listen to several times, and you'll want to take advantage of his other public appearances, a great animated series he's done for GE, and most importantly, the Cutting Carbon podcast that he hosts. We'll link those in the show notes. Second, as you listen, I think you'll be reminded of some of our transportation and trucking episodes. And that's because, like those companies, the portfolio of technologies at GE Vernova has grown significantly to include almost everything, everywhere, and all at once. Let's have Jeff explain.
Tech, cars, machines. Subscribe here or at gtkpartners.com.
Jeff, thank you so much for joining us.
Ali, thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure. Really excited to talk to you today.
Where are you dialing in from today?
I am based in Schenectady, New York, which is one of GE's historic manufacturing sites. It's was one of the sites originally founded by Thomas Edison when he founded the company over a century ago.
Wow, that's excellent DNA in the water, so to speak. Why don't you give us your name, rank, and serial number at GE, and then we'll get a little bit into your personal background.
Well, I don't know about serial number, but so I've been with the company for almost 23 years. I started out as a combustion research engineer in our research center in Neuskina, New York, which is just a few miles up the road from where I'm sitting. I transitioned into the gas turbine business about 16 plus years ago with a focus on combustion and fuels, really being our in-house combustion and fuels expert, supporting customers around the world who are looking to use alternative or non-traditional fuels for power generation. About 5 years ago, really started to focus really more on hydrogen as a pathway for decarbonization. And in one of our reorganizations about 4 years ago, I was asked to join a group that really focused on decarbonization, again, mostly for the gas turbine business, the gas power. But I've actually recently transitioned because my work has grown from just focusing on hydrogen for gas power, gas turbines, but the whole hydrogen value chain. So I'm actually in the process of transitioning out of the gas power business into the strategic marketing organization at the GE Vernova headquarters level to really focus on the hydrogen value chain and what it means for our portfolio of businesses.
Excellent. That's great. And that'll be a great fit for, I think, a series of four podcast episodes that we'll have on hydrogen. The first was a thought piece we did on ACES Delta. The second, that just got released this morning, was with Neil Banwart, who's an executive with Mach 2, the Midwestern Alliance for Clean Hydrogen, which is one of the seven selected hubs. And then we also have the chief investment officer for the Department of Energy coming up right after you. So that'll be just a great series that I think people can put together and almost make it a reference series of episodes for the subject of hydrogen. So Jeff, that's pretty exciting in terms of what you've been doing at GE. I mentioned in the preamble that you are a great teacher, and you recall when we first talked, I kind of noticed that just reviewing your public collateral. Tell us a little bit about why that's kind of in your blood.
Well, first of all, I come from a family of teachers. So in some ways, I wouldn't say being an engineer makes me the black sheep, but there are many more teachers in the family than are engineers. And look, for me, I'm far enough along in my career where I see a responsibility of kind of reaching back over my shoulder, if you will, and helping to groom and grow the next generation as it was done for me. And frankly, there's just a lot of just knowledge there is to share. We're doing a lot of great stuff in GE. There's a lot of great stuff happening around the world. And I think it's incumbent upon many of us to make sure that we're communicating the truth, facts about what's happening. Not everything works well, but we can always trust numbers, right? And we go back to facts and figures. As we think about the energy transition, there's a lot of material out there and a lot of opinions. But I think what we really need to focus on is key facts and knowledge, statistics, and data. And so I think it's really important and incumbent on many of us to help propagate that thought leadership around what we know to be true, what's factual. Like I said, sometimes things work out well and sometimes they don't. And that's kind of my view of part of my role is to help do that. Aside from work I do around mentoring and things of that nature, it's around how do we be thought leaders and industry leaders and help policymakers make good decisions around the energy transition. It's a complicated topic. As anyone who's ever looked at it knows, there are no simple answers. So we've got to be there as a trusted source of knowledge and information for folks around the world.
And Jeff, were you always numbers-oriented and facts-oriented? Is that why you wound up in a technical field?
First of all, as a kid, you know, was always interested in building things. When I figured out what engineering was as a career, that was kind of a done deal for me. And I loved being in the lab and doing research. So I wasn't just a mechanical engineer, you know, with a bachelor's degree. I went on to the master's and the PhD and the postdoc and really loved doing experimental work, diving into details and really understanding phenomenon. And today I continue to be a numbers person from the perspective of, right, do the math, show people the numbers. You want to make a business case around something, let's dive into the numbers, whether it's understanding the technology, understanding the market and the business case. I can say a lot of words, but numbers can show a cold, hard truth. But we can use them to teach and to learn and to make really incredible decisions about how we change the world for the better as we think about the energy transition and the challenge that's incumbent upon our generation to help set the right path for the future. And we do that by doing detailed analysis, figuring out what are the right paths. Then there is no right path. There are multiple paths depending on where you are in the world and where you are in that transition. But understanding those things comes from detailed analysis and understanding these very detailed analyses.
Mm-hmm. And I understand exactly what you mean, Jeff. As a quick aside, I've been taking a few courses taught by a couple STEM professors in local colleges, you know, the geology and earth sciences things. And it's, you know, a good 20 hours of lectures each with some reading, et cetera. And one of the things that's striking about climate change is really how incontrovertible the evidence is, way more than I expected to find just based on reading the lay press. There is no controversy whatsoever in the scientific community. Now, it's science, so there could be a couple observations that change our view of what the correct theory is, and none of them are denying that. But it's really quite striking how clear it is and how clearly it's much worse if you look at the data than you understand if you're just leading the lay press.
And look, for many of us in the U.S., depending on where you live, it doesn't seem to be affecting us day to day. But there are other parts of the U.S., you look at kind of the historic rainfall and snowfall that's happening in California literally this week. Think about this past summer and the heat wave that kind of blanketed the U.S. Southwest. Mm-hmm. You know, how many days was it in Texas where it was above 105 or 110 degrees? Mm-hmm. You think about other parts of the world that are seeing changes in seasons. There's some climate shifts. Mm-hmm. There is a report I was just reading that, you know, one of these large glaciers in the Antarctic, they're getting very worried about it. And like the glacier's like the size of Florida, you know, this ice pack. These are major shifts that are happening. And unfortunately, we didn't get here overnight, so we can't undo it overnight. You know, and this is why we're talking about 2040 and 2050 goals. But like anything else, I always say, right, no one is born and then runs a marathon. You have to learn how to crawl and then walk and run. Right. And then you can learn how to run the marathon. I don't know if we're in the pre-crawl stage or the crawl stage or kind of the learning how to walk on our toes and falling over stage, but we're clearly not walking or running yet. And we've got time, not much, but some time to get it all figured out. But this is why right now, this is such an important time for us to make sure that we are developing some of the key technologies, that we're having conversations with policymakers to really make sure they're informed about these technologies and what's in the art of possible and what's not. So this is just a critical time to really be engaged on the topic.
So Jeff, let's set the table a little bit in terms of what GE Vernova currently does, just the broad portfolio, if you don't mind, and then take us into your particular field of activity.
So maybe just we'll spend a moment on kind of the timeline. So I'm not sure how many of your audience today is familiar with Vernova. So going back to late 2021 is when GE announced the company would split into three independent investment-grade companies. GE Healthcare launched in January of 2023 as an investment-grade company separate. The GE board just announced at the beginning of March, on the 1st, just a week or so ago, that they've approved the separation of what will become GE Aerospace and GE Vernova, and just announced that that launch day is April 2nd, so just a few weeks away. And so starting April 2nd, GE Vernova will become an independent investment-grade company. And the company really has three main pillars. And as you said, Ali, it's really going to be all of the energy businesses from GE all together under in one house. And so the first pillar is our wind businesses. This is our onshore wind business, our offshore wind business, and our LM wind turbine business. For those who don't know, we actually have a business that makes wind turbine blades, not just for GE, but for other OEMs in the industry. We have our power segment, which includes our gas power and steam power businesses, as well as hydro and nuclear. We have our electrification segment, which has our grid solutions business, power conversion, solar and storage solutions, as well as our electrification software business. And then we have what we call accelerators. We have a financial services group. We have an energy consulting or consulting services group, as well as our research center. And our research center, we have one facility in upstate New York and one in Bangalore, India.
Great. Thank you. And just a quick clarification on the software and services. Are you focused on support of your own offerings, or is it more of a grid management offering?
The electrification software business is really focused on the entire ecosystem. We do offer software specifically for our products, but we also have software looking at how do you manage and optimize electrical distribution on the grid? How do you integrate data from all sorts of sources if you're an ISO or some other entity that's looking to how do you manage the grid? So it's not just our specific footprint, but we're really thinking much broader about the energy transition. And what many people don't realize, when we think about power generation, we think about the asset, the gas turbine, the steam turbine, the nuclear plant. We sometimes forget about the wires, right? The physical asset that's moving all that electricity. And frankly, some people call the grid the most complicated machine or system that humanity has ever built, right? For the most part, electricity is consumed the instant it's produced. We don't have large amounts of energy storage. So you have to balance energy production, electricity production, and consumption nearly instantaneously all around the world. That's pretty amazing that that's happening. But now, we're changing the system, which used to be this system of effectively one-way flow, centralized production flowing out towards your end users. But now, as people put solar on their roof, and maybe you've got an EV in your garage that can serve as a battery, you've got maybe microgrids. Now you're starting to see, if not two-way flow of traffic, multi-directional flow of electrons or electricity. And the grids have to manage these systems. And so having software that can help you understand this is really going to be critical to the energy transition.
Perfect. And by the way, just in terms of how technical you'd like to get, you can assume that our audience has a core of about 500 people who are private equity, VC partners, as well as CXOs. And then we have thousands of interactions beyond that. But that's a pretty technical, that's our core listener grouping can get pretty technical. And I guess what you're saying is, what we used to have are these electricity sources that were all dispatchable, meaning you could just kind of turn them on or they're available when you needed them.
Right.
And now, you know, the sun is really good, but it's not around all the time, at least in any specific geographic location. And so you need to have kind of a storage medium to time shift the availability of that thing. And that's, I think, an incredibly complicated problem.
Yep. And it goes beyond that. So energy storage is clearly one. And you can think about, do you do energy storage intraday? Do you have enough battery power that gets you through the hump of the night for those couple hours when there's just not enough wind? Obviously, there's no sun at night. But now do you start to have interday storage where you need storage over multiple days? You know, if you're highly dependent on renewables, and again, I live in upstate New York, you get a nor'easter coming up the East Coast, and next thing you know, you're socked in with clouds for 2 or 3 days. Mm-hmm. Maybe you don't have a lot of solar. Maybe it's cold enough or the winds are strong enough that your wind is not really blowing. What do you do then? The other piece that people don't always realize is today, our grid is primarily made up of rotating equipment that provide inertia. You've got physical spinning mass on the grid. And in the US, that metal spins at 60 hertz, 60 times a second.
You mean the turbines?
Whether it's the generators on your gas turbine, your steam turbine, your nuclear plant, your hydro plant, they are spinning at 3,600 RPM. So you get a 60 hertz frequency. And that's what helps lock your frequency in the grid, because you've got all this physical mass, this inertia. But as you put more and more wind turbines and solar on, they're inverter based, they're electrically based. They don't provide you with that inertia. Now, when you have an issue where you lose a load, a large load, or you lose a large production source, the frequency on your grid can start to shift, but you have this large physical inertia that literally acts as a resistance to that. But as you start having less and less inertia-based resources and more synthetic inverter-based systems, you can have an inertia problem. You hear people talking about putting synchronous condensers on, right? These are machines that just spin to provide that inertia. But the grid today just kind of assumes that inertia is there. And so as you shift to more wind and solar, how do you ensure that you maintain grid frequency stability? Do you create an ancillary service market around providing grid frequency support, right? How do you think about, as we do this shift, it's not just I'm going from dispatchable to non-dispatchable in the sense of going from, you know, gas and steam and nuclear and such to wind and solar and hydro-based. And we can forecast when there might be a cloudier day and think about what resources we need. But I have to think about these other attributes of the grid that we don't always think about, because we normally think about the dispatchable versus non-dispatchable. But there are definitely these other aspects to the grid that we have to think about. Now, you could have grid-forming devices as part of batteries or other systems. But today, again, there's this shift, and we have to make sure that as we shift, we're not just gaining this lower carbon intensity, but are we capturing all the critical requirements of the grid with these new systems, inertia being just one of them?
Well, that's pretty fascinating. So it's not just that the electricity has to come on, but obviously it has to come on at the right voltage for your geography, but also we're used to that electricity turning on and off essentially 60 times a second.
Yeah, there's definitely some elements that make it a little more complicated. So it's not just centralized versus decentralized, but there are solutions. It is technically feasible to do these things, but we have to do them intelligently. And so again, it's more than just a flick of a switch going from, you know, turning off gas turbines and turning on wind. There are some other attributes that we have to think through. And the independent system operators and the TSOs in the US and other countries around the world are well aware of these issues. As they think them through, they're trying to figure out what are the resources they're going to need. How do you start creating the market structure where you do maybe have more need for some of these ancillary services? It's not just its power. How are you doing frequency response and other things that in some cases batteries are good for, and other things you're going to want spinning mass?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Jeff, I imagine this makes it exciting for people like yourself to have so many more things to think about essentially than you used to. But it's also probably true that a lot of the current participants, including GE of Vernova in this space, were really set up to require a certain amount of investment in a certain number of types of technologies. And now there's suddenly so many more things to think about. How does your organization manage having to invest in resolving many more issues than it used to?
I think it comes down to fundamentals, right? Where do you think the investment opportunities are? Mm-hmm. What technologies do you have? How can you make a difference? I think we go back to solid practices around that kind of thought process. You know, I'm not going to get into specific details of, of things we're considering or not considering, but I think a lot of it comes down to asking some of the right questions. Where can we make a difference or not? You know, I think if you look at our portfolio, right, we are very supportive of small modular reactors as next generation technology. We are leveraging work that we've done over years. Our BWRX 300 is basically the 10th evolutionary or 10th iteration on our boiling water reactor, but as a small modular 300 megawatt system, we think there's that can bring a lot of value into, you know, the future electricity system through this energy transition to provide 24/7 carbon-free power. You know, there's a lot of technologies in our portfolio that have been there and are now really going to be key for the energy transition, whether it's, again, onshore, offshore, baseload nuclear power, gas turbines having the ability not to be locked in on carbon, but to leverage our experience with hydrogen, developing an offering for carbon capture. So I think we go to our roots of technology as we think about what are the needs for the energy transition.
It is interesting. So, and I know you can't go into the details, but it's certainly a non-trivial change in the scope of investment that the companies need to make. And I think the major heavy-duty trucking firms are having a lot of sort of fun dealing with this challenge, because for 100 years, they incrementally improved the diesel engine. And then now the regulatory pressure is to make those changes, make those improvements a lot faster. And by the way, also to develop an electric powertrain, a fuel cell-based powertrain, hydrogen fuel cell, and also maybe a hydrogen combustion powertrain. And I noticed in my dealings with them when I'm on a transaction across the table from these folks, in the back and forth, the most valuable resource they currently have is engineering time. And because those people are so stretched across multiple platforms. What's kind of in your portfolio of the various things?
Sure. I come out of the gas turbine business with a combustion background, so gas turbines are near and dear to my heart. But if I think of this as a value chain or a supply chain, a gas turbine's at the far end, right? It's the consumer of that fuel. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm now thinking much more broadly about that value chain of creation. So let's talk hydrogen as an example, but you could pick any sort of system here. So today we make hydrogen by basically splitting up a methane molecule and a steam methane reformer with some steam, you emit CO2 and you get hydrogen. Great. Highly carbon intense. Well, there are things you can do to reduce the carbon intensity there, and it's called blue hydrogen, doing carbon capture. Or you could make hydrogen from an electrolyzer, taking renewable power, solar, wind, hydro. I'll add nuclear because it's carbon free. And now you can run an electrolyzer, split water. Now you've got hydrogen. And now you can think about how do you transport the hydrogen, store the hydrogen, and then you bring it to the end use. Could be a gas turbine. You talked about like a truck with a hydrogen-based internal combustion engine, bring it to a fuel cell. But I'm thinking not just about that end use, but all those intermediate pieces. If we're truly going to grow a hydrogen economy, there are all these amazing things that we need to do. We need to grow renewables as fast as we can, because we want those obviously to decarbonize the grid, but also potentially as a driver for making hydrogen. Mm-hmm. We totally need to invest in carbon capture technologies and the ability to do carbon capture and sequestration. The sequestration is key. And then, of course, there's the fun part where you're talking about, you know, now hydrogen, if we're talking about renewables, I've now basically shifted an electron to a molecule. Now with that molecule, I can store it for weeks or months at a time. You mentioned the Intermountain Project out west, Delta, Utah, right? That's effective what they're doing. But I could also transform the hydrogen. Do I make ammonia? Do I make methanol? Do I make some other molecule? Because if you talk with the shipping industry, they're thinking about how do they basically stop burning bunker C or marine gas oil? How do they decarbonize their industry? Well, they're going to need a lot of hydrogen to do that. The aviation industry, right? There's a lot of talk about SAF, sustainable aviation fuel. Well, they're going to need a lot of hydrogen. So this hydrogen value chain in some way becomes a backbone if we really believe that we're going to use hydrogen to decarbonize all of these end sectors. People talk about using hydrogen instead of like pet coke or blast furnace gas or other materials in steel production. So again, you know, we think about hydrogen could do all these amazing things, but you still need now a supply chain. How do you make the hydrogen? What's that supply chain look like? And again, as I think about this from a Vernova perspective, if you want to talk green hydrogen, solar, wind, hydro, nuclear, Our power conversion business has decades of experience with power electronics, the kind you need to take that electricity from the grid and power an electrolyzer. And you need this electrification software to control these systems. So I'm really excited because there's this whole new world that we're starting to create and being challenged to create. There's probably more questions than I have answers today.
Agreed. No, and just to kind of summarize, and this is really at the 30,000 foot level, I mean, the good thing about hydrogen is it's as close to the regular fuels that we have today as you can get and be carbon free, in the sense that it's storable and transportable more or less in the same way that we can store or transport natural gas or liquid fuels. How true is all of the above, really? And I'm obviously pointing to the compression and embrittlement, some of these other challenges that there are. Speak to us a little bit about that. And from your more sort of technical vantage point, how do you so see those issues as being? How difficult are they to surmount, and how close are we getting to manage them?
So let's talk hydrogen transport and storage.
Perfect.
There's order of magnitude about 1,600 miles of hydrogen pipeline in the U.S., mostly in the Gulf Coast between Texas and Louisiana. So totally doable, right? They're doing it today. Now, are there more advanced materials we should be looking at, or are there concerns about embrittlement? And for the audience, right, embrittlement is hydrogen basically can diffuse into metal, and it can change the grain structure of the metal, making it more brittle over time. And so certain metals have more resistance to that phenomenon than others. But there are some studies that go back decades looking at that. And there's new work that's happening as we think about new materials. So you can transport hydrogen from a technical perspective, not a problem. If you think about a long pipeline and you've got, you know, recompression stations along the way, well, you may have to change what those machines are. If it's a reciprocating engine or a gas turbine, they might be happy working on natural gas today, but you may have to do some upgrades to go make them hydrogen compatible. So I think we can transport the hydrogen. A lot of this issue comes down to cost of hydrogen and volume for production, but I think technically it can be done. I know you talked about, right, you had folks talking about the Delta Utah project. So they're talking about using underground salt caverns for storage. So you can do, that's maybe beyond bulk storage. That's large scale hydrogen storage, but you can store hydrogen in a tank at high pressure. So you can store it. I think the question is scale and cost and such. But as we think about end use of hydrogen, gas turbines have been burning fuels with hydrogen for over 50 years. Typically in industrial cases where you were in a refinery or a steel mill or a petrochem plant, and you had some waste fuel that had some amount of hydrogen, 5, 10, 20, 30% or more. And instead of buying natural gas, you took that waste gas and ran it through your gas turbine to support house load. We even have a turbine that's actually still running today, where the hydrogen content of the fuel has ranged from as low as about 75% to upwards to about 95, 96%. That unit has well over 100,000 hours of operating experience. So the industry as a whole, I did a survey based on materials published by the major OEMs last year, and that was about 17.5 million hours amongst the major gas turbine OEMs. And so you can burn hydrogen in a gas turbine. You could burn 100% hydrogen in some gas turbines today. The limitation of can you burn hydrogen in a gas turbine is not the gas turbine. It's can you get adequate hydrogen volume, and you can get it at a price point that's affordable. You know, hydrogen today tends to be more expensive than natural gas because natural gas is your feedstock. And if you think about how power systems dispatch, they dispatch on lowest cost of electricity. Well, if your fuel cost just doubled, it makes your electricity more expensive and it's harder to dispatch. So the challenges here, I think, are less technical and more around economics and volume. How do you get volume up and price down on hydrogen?
It reminds me of the episode that we just released today about the Hydrogen Hub program that came out of, I think, the Inflation Reduction Act. And, you know, 7 hubs around the country, about $1 billion of investment or a contribution the Department of Energy will make to each. And what was very fascinating in the interview with Neil Banwart was that he emphasized the hubs are not trying to really develop new technology. They're trying to prove the value of scale in a variety of different ways of production and a variety of different applications of hydrogen as an energy source. And so that was, I think, really quite fascinating and dovetails really nicely into the point you just brought up, which is really we need to figure out where can we push the price down at when we have some scale.
And that's where the Inflation Reduction Act, and they just recently announced this past summer the 45E, that's the hydrogen production tax credit. The DOE basically has created these two programs coming from Congress. One is the hubs to help with infrastructure, and the other is help to bring the price down, you know, with this 10-year tax credit. Mm-hmm. The DOE is trying to help kind of the first-of-a-kind projects, but also kind of build out long-term infrastructure. And that 45B, depending on how you're producing hydrogen, are you meeting the prevailing wage guidelines? You can get upwards of $3 per kilogram subsidy in hydrogen. And for the audience, the conversion I use is a dollar per kilogram is roughly equal to $7.40 per million BTU on a higher heating value. So if they're going to give you $3 a kilogram, order of magnitude, that's about $22 per million BTU. And that's depending on where your hydrogen is. Your hydrogen's at $30 or $40 per million BTU. You know, you could take maybe upwards of half or more of that cost out. Now, it's not necessarily comparable yet with natural gas, which is what Henry Hub, I didn't look this morning, but it had been trading somewhere in the order of about $3 per million BTU. So they're not quite equivalent yet, but this moves you down that path. And if you think about other fuels, diesel, gasoline, on a dollars per million BTU basis, they tend to be more in the teens or low 20s if you can throw in jet fuel as well. So now if you can get hydrogen down in the $15 to $20 per MMBTU range, now maybe you can start thinking, if you had the technologies and infrastructure, could it be a substitute for other things? So we're making progress. Like I said, right? We're not definitely running the marathon, but I think we're starting to crawl maybe. We're getting there. It's, you know, we're starting to move down the path.
Exactly. It's very, very true. And, you know, you mentioned the various incentives and the subsidies that the federal government has, and it's not a fair comparison because you have one fuel source that's allowed to store its byproduct in the atmosphere, right, to significant detrimental impact. How can you compete with, you know, it's sort of like the manufacturers in the States complain that people elsewhere get to dump their byproduct into the local river. So how do you compete with that?
What's the social cost, if you will, right? Right. And you can solve that problem. You could just by fiat, say there's a carbon tax on everything. That, of course, has potential negative impacts on economic growth if you just kind of slap a carbon tax everywhere. Right. It's one path of doing it. The other path is subsidizing these new technologies. And frankly, in some ways, that's the role of government, right? The capital system will always look to optimize and minimize cost. But new technologies that are disruptive sometimes do need that private-public partnership and government support to help bring the cost down, because private industry won't do it on its own. Mm-hmm. And banks sometimes can be adversely, they just look at new technology, it's not yet proven, and you want to go for that financing, you know, how do the banks look at that, right? Why is the DOE have this major loan program around the energy transition, right? Because there are projects that need first of a kind that need to prove that. And for a first of a kind project, it may be harder to get a loan or a loan at rational rates from a bank. Well, this is where the government can step in. It can help scale up. It can help bring these subsidies, get you those first couple of projects, prove the technology is viable at scale, move you down the cost curve, help with insurability, help with those loans. You know, there's a real value to what the government can do in these places, and it's critical. And by the way, it's not just happening in the US. You can look at what's happening in Europe, Canada, Australia, Japan. It's recognized around the world that governments are leading here with policy, looking at the private sector in many cases to develop the technology. Some of that technology can come out of a government lab as well, but you definitely need this public-private partnership when we're in the infancy of this kind of transition.
Very true. And we tend to forget how many of the things that we're used to really came about, the government providing a lot of initial support. I don't mean just the internet. I'm talking about the railroads, right? They were built along land grants across the country.
Think about the interstate system we take for granted today. Right. You know, if you just left it up to states or private entities, would we have the interstate system that was built? I don't think we would. So the government does have a role to play.
Exactly. You know, you've touched a little bit on the hydrogen pipeline infrastructure that's existed in the Gulf Coast states. And I'm assuming that that hydrogen is there not to provide, not to transport energy, but to act as feedstock for some variety of chemical production activities. Tell us a little bit more about that. What has been the experience with building those pipelines and maintaining them over time? Is it really indicative of what could be done on a broader scale in the country?
So first, I'll admit, I'm not a petroleum engineer. I'm not a pipeline expert. What I do know is those pipelines are, I believe, predominantly privately owned by the oil and gas companies. And to your point, you know, hydrogen plays a large role in refinery operations. Mm-hmm. As you're doing the distillation and production of gasoline and other fuels, it is a key component. And so a lot of what happens there is hydrogen production either in-house for this, or I'll call them merchant hydrogen producers who, mm-hmm. you know, sell their hydrogen to other users.
Right.
But the pipeline there isn't new. It's been there a long time. And so, again, I think it's proven it's viable. You can do it. I think the question is, and I was just asked this recently, if we think about going forward, I think the DOE is looking towards these hubs, right, to start developing the local infrastructure that they would need. Now, I'm hoping that the hubs have support from their local states, and if they need to build the infrastructure, they'll get the support they need. But I have no knowledge other beyond kind of what you and I might read in the paper together about these things.
Okay.
But again, the existing pipelines are really there supporting the oil and gas industry, predominantly in the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, exactly. I remember I was working on something, and I had a few people from one of the largest oil companies in the world, and they were telling me, "No, I mean, these issues you have with corrosion and embrittlement, it's not an issue. We know how to handle it." Again, you know, what is the cost of scaling it up for the particular applications that we're talking about? That's another issue, but it doesn't seem to be a real technical challenge as far as they're concerned.
I'll come back to, it's really more about production of hydrogen at scale. Mm-hmm. What does the cost of hydrogen look like? And what are the end use sectors you want to bring that hydrogen to? And does the hydrogen buy its way in at the right volume level, or does it need subsidy to help during that transitional period until you can get the cost down independently because you've built up larger facilities, you've been able to bring costs down through innovation or other things? Let me just give a real example to your listeners about scale. Mm-hmm. So April of 2022, we ran a demonstration in partnership with the New York Power Authority, NYPA, and the Electric Power Research Institute, EPRI. NYPA had an aeroderivative gas turbine, LM6000. That's roughly a 44 megawatt gas turbine, a simple cycle unit. So doesn't have the combined cycle in the back end. So just the gas turbine runs. We ran that gas turbine on a blend of hydrogen and natural gas. We ran it up to 44% hydrogen. The power plant's on Long Island. There's no hydrogen pipeline in New York. So we had to truck the hydrogen in to the site. And really the limiter of how much we could run was based on hydrogen supply. We brought in, depending on the test day, either 5 or 6 trailers of hydrogen, 2 trailers. Each trailer holds nominally about 100,000 cubic feet, give or take. We'd consume all of those trailers in an afternoon. That's 44% hydrogen on a 44 megawatt gas turbine. All that hydrogen, 5 or 6 tube trailers in an afternoon. Right. So if I'm now thinking I want to go run a large scale gas turbine base loaded on hydrogen, I have a new challenge. I need to provide hydrogen the way with natural gas with a pipeline, with a distribution system. And we're not there yet. Mm-hmm. The flip side is, imagine I want to do a gas turbine with carbon capture, right? Natural gas comes to the power plant today, no problem. But now I need the infrastructure to take that carbon that I've captured off the back end and now bring it to that sequestration site. I don't know if it's a mile away or 10 miles or 50 miles, but I need infrastructure there. So a lot of the challenge here in the power sector, when we want to take existing power plants or new power plants, and again, we do want that dispatchability of power plants. We do want to be able to turn on power when we don't have sufficient sun or wind. If we're decarbonizing them, either hydrogen or another alternative, zero or low carbon fuel or carbon capture, is infrastructure, right? You got to have that infrastructure to bring the new fuel in or to take the CO2 out. And so infrastructure is a key element to the energy transition. And frankly, if we're talking about adding gigawatts of wind in the US, I have to have new grid connections, new grid interconnects. I have to go, and the windiest parts of the US aren't necessarily where people live. And so I can put new wind in the Midwest, but now I have to bring new HVDC lines to move that power to the population center. So infrastructure is absolutely key for the energy transition. We've got many of the technologies in place already, but getting things in place and that critical infrastructure is just huge.
Wow. It makes me feel like construction is a good field to go into if you're a young person looking for a good 40, 50 year career.
We may need a lot of linemen. A lot of linemen.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's been a real sort of tour de force explanation of a lot of things, especially centered around hydrogen. Are there other aspects of what you're working on that that you should talk about, and we'll talk about as many as you want, because I'm getting a good buzz here listening to you be excited about it all.
Yeah, look, one of the things I'll talk about, something we announced at the beginning of the year. So let's talk about, we've talked a lot about the U.S., and the U.S. is blessed in many cases with a lot of natural resources, right? We have a lot of land for renewables. We have a significant amount of domestic fossil fuels. But imagine you're not the U.S., you're now in Japan, a country with a relatively small footprint, highly mountainous, so not necessarily the best place for a lot of wind or solar, a country that today is heavily dependent on the import of fossil-based fuels, coal, oil, gas, with a mandate to be decarbonized by 2050. So what do you do? Now, I'm not going to get into the discussion around should Japan use or not use nuclear, but they're thinking a lot about how could you replace existing fossil fuels with something else? Mm-hmm. So a lot of discussion around hydrogen. The problem with hydrogen is we all go back to, you know, chemistry and physics and stuff we all touched on in high school or college. Hydrogen is a gas, condenses to a liquid at a very cold temperature. And by very cold, it's minus 250 degrees C. That's 20 degrees above like absolute zero, 20 degrees above the temperature of space. It's like minus 400 something Fahrenheit. And to do that, you consume roughly about a third of the energy equivalent of the heating value of a single kilogram. So liquefying hydrogen consumes a crazy amount of energy. But if you're Japan and thinking about wanting to import zero carbon fuels, whether it be for transportation or power or to make sustainable aviation fuel, whatever you'd want that hydrogen for, you're looking for another molecule to move it. One of the simplest molecules that contains hydrogen, but only contains one other molecule that's not carbon, right? Because methane, CH4, is really simple and it's just carbon and hydrogen, but you want something without the carbon, is ammonia, NH3. We've been making ammonia as a society for a century. It's a fundamental building block in fertilizer. Mm-hmm. And without fertilizer, we really couldn't feed the billions of people on the planet. So there's a huge interest actually in Asia now about transforming hydrogen to ammonia, because ammonia, unlike hydrogen, condenses, it becomes a liquid at minus 33 degrees C. Put in perspective, LNG, you transport it like minus 160. So this is much warmer than even LNG. And so there are ships today that move liquid ammonia around the world. We move order of magnitude about 15 million tons a year. So what we announced in January is a collaboration with IHI Corporation Japan to develop a combustion system that could burn 100% ammonia. So over the next 2 years, we're going to do some of this concept development work to kind of validate and test this technology to see if we can make it work. If it does, that provides us maybe a pathway to have retrofittable technology for our gas turbines where you could burn ammonia in a gas turbine. And so that opens up a new pathway for countries that might want to import a zero carbon fuel. We're really excited. There's some other projects we're doing as we think hydrogen value chain. There's a demo project we're doing in the Port of Rotterdam. That's the site of our Haliade X prototype. Haliade X is our 14 megawatt offshore wind turbine. We've announced that we want to do a very small pilot to demonstrate that you could run an electrolyzer off an offshore wind turbine, because there are a lot of folks thinking about, if we're going to put gigawatts of offshore wind and we want to produce hydrogen from it, could you closely integrate and couple that electrolyzer with the wind turbine? But it's not as simple as I just hook up the leads from the electrolyzer to the cable from the wind turbine. There's a lot of power electronics and other control systems that have to be put in place. So we've got this pilot project where we're developing with some key partners there. There's work we're doing with the U.S. Department of Energy. There's work that's happening with our power conversion business. We've developing a collaboration with Next Hydrogen in Canada. They're an electrolyzer provider to do some interesting work. So we're thinking about this whole value chain, not just the gas turbine piece, but all these other pieces of it. Some of this we're doing because it's interesting and valuable, and some of it we're doing because we're thinking about the value chain overall. So we're, you know, thinking about how do we advance technology, and advancing that technology might actually have value for the value chain overall. So we've got a lot of stuff going on here. Again, with all these 12 business units plus these accelerators, just amazing amounts of things happening in the company, more than even just the time we've spent. We could just kind of go business by business by business and talk about some of the innovations. We just don't have the time today.
Well, maybe we'll start a series where we do one a month, because you said there are 12 businesses, right?
12, correct.
That's perfect for one a month. What's fascinating about what you're describing, tell me if my impression is correct, is that the future of energy and energy generation, including electricity, the infrastructure is a lot more heterogeneous than it used to be. Not that it was ever completely homogeneous, but just how you produce it and how you mitigate the consequences of that production, how you move it around and store it and all that, there's just a lot more to it than there used to be. Is that correct?
I think so, because I look at this diversity of solutions, and a lot of it will depend on where you are and given circumstances. Again, the U.S., a lot of land, wind and solar makes a lot of sense because we have the land. But if you're a country like Singapore, you don't necessarily have the land to do a lot of wind and solar. So you may have to have a different solution where you're importing fuel. You think about a country like Australia that today exports a lot of coal. What will support their economy in the future? I think about Europe. You know, every country, again, you think about where they are in their transition, what natural resources they have. There are going to be some differences in policies based on what the citizens of that country or region expect or want. And so we think of this as a multi-speed journey, right? Every country in the world is starting at a different place. You know, the US versus Germany versus India versus Japan versus Australia versus, you know, country A, B, C, D, E. No two countries are exactly in the same position. Even a country like the UK compared to the US, their grid code, because being an island country, right, is very different than ours. And so that puts very different constraints on the system. Even if you say they might have the same technology mix, how it gets applied could be different. So you've got to think of this country by country, region by region. And I like to think as we have a toolbox of solutions and we can apply those solutions. You know, maybe some solutions work better for some regions and others not. But that's the value of this, of having this variety, these solution sets. We can bring all these technologies to bear based on, you know, what's needed in any given country or region.
It's quite interesting in that if you look into the future, the role of GE Vernova may be much broader than it is today. In other words, you originally provide the equipment, then you provided the software and services wrappers around it. And I'm wondering if there's a future where you basically hand over the two endpoints of the wires, which the electricity is coming from it. Everything else has to be handled by you because your customers aren't used to doing it all on their own.
We think of ourselves as a purpose-built company that's positioned for, you know, decades of growth, but really focusing on both electrifying and decarbonizing the world with a unique scope and scale solutions to help accelerate the transition. So look, we're incredibly excited about the energy transition because of the portfolio of technologies. These technologies we have in these 12 businesses, again, I think about wind and solar and gas and nuclear and hydro and grid. So we don't just have the producers of electricity. We have technologies to help store, to transmit electricity. These are all going to be needed as we basically re-envision our electrical system, our energy system.
It's a fascinating future. You know, if you were sitting here 20 years from now, what would you like to have seen happen? What's likely to be different?
Well, look, it's hard to predict. I remind people, if you look back 20 some odd years and think about the wind business as we know it today looked nothing like it did in 2000. The beginnings of, you know, the wind turbines were much smaller. We hadn't had 20 years of tax credits. You know, we think about now the wind business as just this massive entity that's providing huge amounts of carbon-free power to the world. I don't know in the year 2000, people would have predicted that. So if I say, hey, if we have sustained policy, and that's key, sustained policy that helps drive the energy transition, I think the world in 2040 or 2045 could look dramatically different than it does today. You know, we could see places that are leveraging clean nuclear power, that is carbon-free nuclear power to provide baseload. You know, we could see places with significant amount of wind and solar. We could see hydrogen being leveraged in these hard to decarbonize sectors, whether it's steel or cement, making sustainable aviation fuel or supporting other sectors, let's say marine. You know, we could see direct air capture being leveraged to help pull carbon out of the air, to help reverse what we've all put in. But a lot of it comes down to we need sustained policy, right? We've got to keep all moving in the same direction. You know, think about a crew team. Everyone's got to row at the same time at that right cadence. We need global policy to continue moving us in the right direction. We can get the technology piece, but we need that public-private partnership. I think the world could be amazing, in an amazing place where we solve many of these issues in the next two decades. I think it's incumbent upon us to help leave the world a better place than we found it. And that means working together to solve these challenges.
Agreed. Let me ask you this. Now, more would always be better, but with the current state of government incentives and involvement and public-private partnership, if that was sustained for the next 20 years, would the future be pretty bright? Or are we far short of what we should be doing today, to even if we were to continue it for 20 years?
It's a great question. I'm not sure I know the answer. I think we're definitely moving in the right direction, but there's so many nuances, again, depending on where you are in the world. Mm-hmm. I think in the US, we've definitely started moving it in the right direction. And I think it's right now, I think we've got to go maybe see how some of these policies have been launched, how they get executed, right? Today, the 45V tax credit, it's not quite all the rules aren't in place yet. So I can't comment on whether it's working or not working. But maybe we come back and have this conversation in 2 or 3 years and see, looking back over our shoulder, are things moving in the right direction? I think it's still really early, right? Some of these policies in the US, we're just starting to get the guidance of how to execute. But look, we're having the conversation about policies and about the subsidies and what we're going to do. And that's movement in the right direction. So I'm very hopeful.
That's great to hear. Go back to something which you said in the beginning, which is the importance of communication. What are the components of the communication that are the most important? Is it really for people to embrace how dire the predictions are for average global temperatures? Or is it more understanding that no matter how expensive things may look today, there's a track record of bringing those costs down? What are some of the key hurdles that you would like to overcome?
My personal perception here is I think we just need global acceptance that climate change is real. There should be no denying it. As you said right from the beginning, right, there's just a preponderance of data that indicates this. And we can look around the world. You look at natural disasters, hurricanes and heat waves and such, and the predictions is they're going to get worse. Maybe we have less hurricanes, but the hurricanes are more powerful. The cost after each of these natural disasters is measured, if not in tens of billions or hundreds of billions, maybe even in trillions now. You know, there are reports that say the investment required to change trajectory in total is less than we would spend if we do nothing and just basically keep mopping up after these disasters. I think, again, sustained policy to drive this and keep the momentum up. But I think we just need everyone to agree. It's real. It's happening. And we all need to work on it together. I'm excited. I think this is an amazing time to be an engineer or a scientist or a policymaker, because this is a challenge that we've been given to go make the world a better place. I know in GE Vernova, as we talk about our purpose of electrifying and decarbonizing the world, that's a challenge we're leaning into. I think we just need more people to think about it. I tell young people, this is an amazing time to be in the energy field, right? There is more work than we know what to do. We need great scientists and engineers and technicians and linemen. And we need a whole workforce to help support us here. It's an amazing time because there's so much work to do. And we're going to go reinvent and rebuild the electrical system. We're being asked to do that in 20 years. Well, today's electrical infrastructure got built up over a century. So this is a monumental task, and it's very exciting to be asked to be part of it. So it's an opportunity, but it's a responsibility at the same time, that we've got this burden placed on our shoulders to help deliver this to the world, not just as me or GE Vernova, but the whole industry.
Jeff, I very much appreciate not just the knowledge you've imparted, but the energy and enthusiasm you've brought to it. And I know, like I said in the beginning, I think our listeners will listen several times. I know every time I want an energy boost, no pun intended, I think I'll take a listen to this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great. And Ali, I'd be remiss if I did let your listeners know, if they want to know more about GE Vernova, I'm the host of a podcast called Cutting Carbon. And we just launched in, well, it's 2023, I say just, it's over the last year, our 7th, 8th, and 9th seasons. Each of the episodes in those seasons focused a conversation with a CEO of one of the GE businesses, talking about their businesses, the opportunities, the headwinds. So for folks who want to learn more about GE Vernova and any of those businesses, you can find Cutting Carbon online at any of your favorite locations, would be Amazon or iTunes or Spotify. You know, take a listen. You can, like I said, we've got over a dozen episodes now on each of these GE businesses with their CEO. So great opportunity for your audience who want to learn more about GE Vernova to have some deep dives into those businesses.
Thank you for mentioning that. We'll put a link to your podcast series in the episode notes. And is there anything else you want to mention?
I just want to thank you again for the opportunity to have this great conversation. Really excited about the energy transition. I'm really excited about GE Vernova launching on April 2nd, you know, charting this brand new future with effectively, you know, being a founder of a brand new company. It's a very exciting time.
Well, I wish you luck, and so do my kids.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tech, cars, machines. Subscribe here or at gtkpartners.com.